In the adoption machine, Paul Jude Redmond, who's chairperson of the Coalition of Mother and Baby Home Survivors, who himself was born in the Castle Pollard home, reveals the shocking history of one of the worst abuses of church power since the foundation of the Irish state. We're talking about the collusion between church and state in the systematic repression of women and the willful neglect of illegitimate babies, resulting in the death of thousands. Paul Jude Redmond joins us now. Thank you for joining us, Paul. Appreciate it.
Surely.
Yes. I mean, we've talked about this on the show before, but we've never heard it from the point of view who's somebody like yourself who was actually born in one of these homes. At what point in your life did the realisation happen?
Of how bad these places were. Well,
yeah.
I always knew I was adopted.
Of course.
But the realisation only kind of dawned about 7 years ago because, in essence, there was very little known about the homes up to that point in the public domain. And I was one of several people who started researching them at the same time.
Oh.
And it was quite a shock. The further I went into it, the more shocked I was at what I found. And obviously I was doing that as a campaigning tool because we were looking for a public inquiry at the time. And slowly but surely all the work I did over the years came together and culminated in the book.
Yeah, so let's have a look at what we're actually talking about here for those who, I mean, there can't be many people who are not aware of but they maybe are not aware of the true horror and the numbers involved here. You talk about... in May 2014, when the Irish woke up to a mass grave, and that had the remains of almost 800 babies in the so-called Angels Plot, the Tuam Mother and Baby Home. I mean, that's an appalling number, isn't it?
It certainly is, and it's Tuam is about the fourth or fifth biggest of nine mother and baby homes here. And that particular story, of course, famously went around the world and absolutely blew everything wide open here. But yeah, there were certainly bigger homes and equally as bad as Tuam. Our best estimate now is that a bare minimum of 6,000 babies and children died in nine mother and baby homes.
What went on, to kind of paraphrase it, is that mothers who were young and became pregnant or had been decided by somebody, and it's not clear who, that they were unfit to be mothers, went into these homes and their babies were taken from them. And in a lot of cases, those babies were sent to America, weren't they, from Ireland?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't the case of somebody here decided that they were unfit mothers. The mere fact that you were a single mother in Ireland, especially during the period we now refer to as Holy Catholic Ireland, that automatically ruled you out as being a fit mother. It's almost as though motherhood itself was made illegitimate along with the babies like myself. And yeah, there was about 35,000 women went through the homes. And out of that, about somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 babies went to America from the late 40s until the early 70s. And they were effectively sold. It was child trafficking on an international scale, basically, and it was perfectly legal at the time.
You were adopted, I believe, at 17 days old. So what was your story? Where did you end up?
Oh, well, I ended up being adopted by a Dublin couple,
and
my mum and dad. I was blessed, absolutely have a fabulous family and grow up in a loving, very, very loving family. We're brothers and sister. And that's true for the vast majority of us who were born in the homes as well, that those of us who were adopted because our parents were vetted and checked out by social services and all concerned and needed references and everything, the vast majority of us went to very decent homes where we were wanted and loved, and there's no complaints about us on that side. In fact, most of us consider that our adoptive parents were kind of victims in a way themselves, in that they were told that they were saving us from a fate almost worse than death in the industrial schools. And that is true to a large extent. If we weren't adopted back in the early days, we were basically stuffed into an orphanage for a few years and then sent on to hellhole industrial schools in Ireland.
Right. And did you ever make any attempt to find out about your original mother?
Oh, I did, yeah. I was intensely curious about her from a very young age, and I started searching when I was 15. But the system here was obsessively secret, and adoption was always sealed for life here, and it remains so to this day, despite talk over the last few years of opening the records. It's still lifelong sealed in Ireland. But yeah, eventually I did track her down, and through the intervention of an uncle, I had a 40-minute phone call with her about 4 or 5 years ago. And that's it. There'll be nothing else. I was 48 years of age before that happened. And it was made clear to me during that phone call that she simply couldn't handle any more contact. She is literally too traumatised by the experience. She's put it behind her and got on with her life, and she can't go back. She's literally just not able to. So, unfortunately, I had to walk away after that phone call and leave the poor woman in peace, which is a tragedy for all concerned, but it's neither her fault nor mine. It was the church and state acting together.
Yes.
Who decided she was an unfit mother and she shouldn't be let near me.
Those who have seen the film Philomena will know what we're talking about here, and those who haven't ought to watch it, because it looks like it's a made-up story, but of course it's completely true, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And Philomena, yeah, it's one of the many, many tragic stories involved, where by the time Philomena found her son, he'd already passed away.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, what you see in the newspapers of happy reunions after 40 and 50 years, they're a teeny, teeny, tiny percentage of the reality of what happens, because in the vast majority of cases, when one party goes looking for the other, they will often find somebody is dead or find somebody who doesn't want any contact. And it leads to lifelong heartache and tragedy for tens of thousands of people in Ireland, and indeed across the world. And even in Ireland, Spain is one of the notorious countries for forced adoption.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm well aware of the figures.
Well, I think the figures that you're referring there to the lost children of General Franco, and 30,000 plus are the numbers. You know, it's extraordinary, and for years,
extraordinary figures,
that you know the parents didn't know whether the child died or was kidnapped. Just awful. And you mentioned there the collusion between the church and the state, and that actually makes this worse, doesn't it? Because the church doing it, that's horrific. But for then the state to collude, that really is not on.
It's not, but at the same time, it's very understandable in an Irish context, because when we essentially gained our freedom from British rule back in 1922, our government were essentially a bunch of completely inexperienced rebels and gunmen. They had no idea how to run the country, and the church was already there, bedded into the institutions of Ireland. And so that just continued. The church hung on to its institution and said, look, we'll keep on doing this. And not only that, we'll build a new network of institutions of mother and baby homes in the early years of the state, which they did.
Right.
And there was just no understanding in government that this was a horrible thing to do, and it was already horrendously outdated by the 1920s, because the rest of the English-speaking world were closing down their institutions, because there was a realisation that large-scale institutional care simply does not work. And yet the Irish Catholic Church just turned their back on international best practice and progress, hung on to their institutions, and by the time anybody in this country realised what was going on, it was way too late. And then the problem was compounded when Éamon de Valera came into power in 1932, and he was there essentially until 1960, and he was a deeply conservative Catholic himself, so with a perfect collusion of church and state, they really did... they were on the same wavelength ideologically across the board, and they simply thought single mothers are unfit mothers, and their children should be taken from them instantly as soon as humanly possible, and that is what happened in this country well into the 1970s, and tapered off in the 1980s finally.
And one of the things which is still going on, and this really, there is no excuse for this, is that in the case of Tuam, for example, you have to learn of the news of that via the media. The ministers and the Commission of Inquiry are just not communicating, which is unacceptable.
I'm something I'm personally very angry about, and I've called for the minister's resignation a couple of times publicly, because We've been kept at arm's length from day one, and you can see the disastrous effects of that from day one, both on our community and at a very early stage. There was what they call a scoping exercise, where the government put together a very quick report to just get a general idea of the size and scale of what they were dealing with. They completely refused our help in that. And it came out and it was just riddled with flaws. There was some literally basic school child errors in it, because they wouldn't ask us for help. We did make representations. I have to say that the Minister James Riley, while he was there, was listening to us, and we did make a fair bit of progress under his watch. But the inquiry has kept us at arm's length, and when Riley was replaced by Minister Catherine Sapone, basically, we've had one meeting. We waited months for it, and we haven't been able to have a second meeting since. We've just been completely sidelined and forgotten about by the minister. She has no interest in our causes, and that's just ongoing at the moment, unfortunately.
Yes, and you're presented, of course, with a dilemma, and you're very heavily involved in this. That there's worse potentially to come in terms of what's going to be uncovered, and you and others are asking the question, well, really, should any further excavations be pursued? And living survivors and their needs must be put first before they just blindly go off and do this.
Absolutely. And a lot of us are very influenced by Derek Leinster, who's been at this since 1993. Campaigning for the Protestant Bethlehem. Derek has always maintained that living survivors must take priority, that inquiries and memorials, excavations, all of that can wait. But we as a community are dying now, because in his 25 years of campaigning, Derek has just lost so many of his friends and crib mates from the Bethlehem. He's very keenly aware of that. And a lot of the rest of us, like Clodagh Malone and people, Theresa Heine, who are heavily involved, we all feel the same way these days. Take care of living survivors first, sort them out, and then the rest will come. But on the issue of what's to happen to all the angels of plots around the country, that is a very tricky and difficult and complex and emotive subject for our community, and there's no consensus. Certainly some people want them all excavated. In the case of Tuam, I can understand why, because the thought of all those babies essentially buried in a septic tank and waste sewage tank, it is so disrespectful to them and so abusive to the remains of those babies. I think a lot of us would like to see Tuam excavated. Some people wouldn't. The rest of the Angels plots, there's no huge appetite for excavations, because at the end of the day, we could be talking about several thousand bodies upwards.
So worse could potentially be yet to come then?
In terms of the numbers, I think we know the rough outline of what's going to come out from the inquiry, but undoubtedly there will be a few shocks. But there's such a shopping list of abuses there, from the donations of hundreds of dead bodies to medical science to save themselves the cost of funerals and graves, to the vaccine trials, to the banished babies, thousands of babies being sold around the world. We know the broad outlines, but undoubtedly the full facts and figures are going to shock this nation to its core, because there's no question it's going to be the worst single human and civil rights abuses in the history of the Irish state. No question about that since independence.
And you're the chairperson of the Coalition of Mother and Baby Home Survivors. What is your ideal scenario here? If you could write the ideal scenario, there's nothing ideal about the situation, but going forward, what would you pray to happen?
Well, as a community, we're essentially on the same wavelength. We're fighting for two fundamental things. The first is full inclusion, because we believe the big issue here is the separation of single mothers and their children since the foundation of the state. So we'd like to see every woman who lost a child to adoption or fostering or by whatever name included in this inquiry, because a lot have been left out if they weren't incarcerated in one of the mother and baby homes or the county homes. So full inclusion is our number one priority, followed by an immediate acknowledgement, apology and redress from the government. And it really is that simple to us. That's what we want. And then we'd have time for things like memorials and, you know, talking about things like enhanced medical cards for survivors, particularly the more elderly survivors among us. But yeah, those two simple things just include all of us and speed it up and get it over and done with, because our community is just dying at such a ferocious rate. It's something we're all very keenly aware of. The activists and campaigners among us are just, we feel that pressure all the time to get it done as soon as possible. But we're getting no traction from ministers on either of those big ticket issues to us. We're just...
beggar's belief.
We're just being told to wait.
Beggar's belief.
Sorry.
Well, you've put it all down in a book, which I'm sure people will want to have a look at. It's called The Adoption Machine. And I guess, you know, the more people that know about these horrors, the more traction that you will have as a group, I guess, Paul.
Absolutely. I kind of said in the foreword of the book that it was, you know, the book is a lot of things to me, a personal this, and it's a memorial to what happened to, and it's bearing witness. But it's also an activist tool, so to speak, in that I hope that once the word gets out there more and people are more outraged, hopefully, after they read it, and I hope people are angry after they read it and they do contact politicians and the press and demand that action be taken. So that was part of my motivation for writing it.
Well, Paul, thank you firstly for writing it. Thanks for coming on and being so honest today. We hope that you get what you're looking for. It's the least you can expect, frankly. The book's called The Adoption Machine. Paul Jude Redmond, thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome. Thanks. Lovely to talk to you.